Like, if we were doing a list of Bay Area greatest athletes, then longevity and production while in the Bay Area or while representing the Bay Area had to be weighted pretty heavily. And it also made me want to be as representative as I could be with this list across the teams of the Bay Area. Although, spoiler alert, much to the dismay of many, I still do not have any San Jose Sharks on the list.
No one does. No one had a single San Jose Shark.
And frankly, if Ray doesn't, then I feel justified. Now, I say all that to begin by saying that my methodology may not totally have extended to my number 10, because not only did I put two names at number 10, but I ignored the team sports and ignored longevity in the Bay Area, and I chose Tommy Smith and John Carlos. And I don't know if I would have done that 6 months ago. I mean, it's just impossible for me to say.
To go along with your logical bouncing ball, I did not put Colin Kaepernick's name on my list, because he's not deserving of athletic recognition. But cultural relevance, my God, he could be number one, right? You know, so
absolutely.
I totally get where you're coming from with the two of them.
Exactly. And to use Kaepernick as a jumping off point, to me, where Kaepernick, look, he had some flash of tremendous success in a very short time in the NFL. That is not the equivalent of two Olympic medals. And we're talking about the first and third best at the thing they do in the entire world. And not only that, but then they used the platform in front of the entire world to take an important stand for an important thing. And that gets you on my list. So Tommy Smith and John Carlos are tied or share the 10th spot. I could not, although they are medalists, put them higher, because really, to me, this is about team sports. So moving on, number 9, and this was really difficult, but because of the success, I felt somebody had to represent the 2010s Giants. And as much as Madison Bumgarner had the biggest success and the most dramatic performance in any one championship, nobody to me is a more critical part of the entire experience than Buster Posey. And he certainly has the greatness with an MVP award, a Rookie of the Year, batting title. And for teams that largely succeeded on pitching, I think everybody agrees Buster Posey was a component of that pitching. So that's how Buster gets to my number 9. And if we're giving out spots here to great players who were baseball champions in the Bay Area, how can I ignore Reggie Jackson? So Reggie Jackson is my number 8. He would be higher, except that a lot of his great success, again, happened outside of the Bay Area. Which brings me to number 7, and I just felt like I had to get a Raider in here. And there is not one Raider or two Raiders like the other sports that stand out as so great that they just couldn't be kept off. So I was fighting between a few guys. But ultimately, when it comes to having greatness, having your peak be truly great, and winning titles, I felt like Jim Plunkett was the guy who deserved the spot on the list. So Jim Plunkett, plus additional Bay Area ties, of course.
Get that Heisman.
Bring in Plunkett. Exactly. Great success in the Bay Area as a collegiate and professional football player. And now we get into, to me, this is the top 6, and I don't know why anyone would not agree that this is the top 6. Order we can debate, but I don't know how you go away from this. Number 6 is Barry Bonds. And based on what I just said, he had to be in the top 6 for me, because he might be the greatest baseball player ever, and he might even have been the greatest baseball player ever had he never touched a performance-enhancing drug. Unfortunately, he did that, so I never get to know, so he is number 6. Number 5, Ricky Henderson, greatest leadoff hitter of all time, obviously a top 5 Bay Area athlete to me. I'd like to have him higher, but this is a really good list. And number 4 is Willie Mays. Many will tell you he's the greatest baseball player of all time. He's certainly in the top 3 to 5, so he makes number 4 on this list. Joe Montana at number 3, retired as the consensus greatest quarterback ever. Few have been as productive win-wise as he. Number 2, Stephen Curry. He hasn't had his full career, which, apologies to Buster Posey, he's essentially the only guy on this list who hasn't had his full career. And the winning combined with the way he changed the game get him up to number two. But for me, if you have the greatest player to play a sport in your city, I don't understand how you don't put him number one on your greatest athletes of the area. So Jerry Rice, to me, is number one because he's the greatest football player ever. There it is.
It's a solid list. The logical bouncing ball hits all the Plinko slots that you were hoping it to hit. I mean, I understood where you were coming from the whole way through. I would say your biggest reach might be Posey, and he is among the greatest San Francisco Giants ever. So, I mean, it's a good list, man. We essentially have the exact same top six, a little out of order.
Right.
My omission, I did not have Reggie Jackson, but I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong for putting Reggie Jackson on the list. That's for sure. I like your list. I like your list. It's a good list. I was ready to argue with you. I look at it this way. I wanted to argue with you about something, but I'm not gonna.
Ray, I feel like you probably watched more Plunkett than anyone else on the show. How do you feel about him being the Raider that I chose?
I think he's the problem with the Raiders, and you alluded to it yourself, is that there are six or seven guys who are of sort of equal impact, because they don't, as greatest athletes, probably none of them. But in
Tim
terms
Brown,
of impact,
right? Tim
yeah,
Brown.
Brown was on my short list, no doubt. Brown was a late cut.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Tim Brown guy because I think he's largely a numbers compiler who never really made teams dramatically better by his presence, which is why Rice is probably the only wide receiver ever who would make a list, because he did make his team materially better every time he played.
Boss, Randy Moss.
But when I looked at the Raiders as a whole, what I kept coming back to was that the best players, you know, when you grade them out, are the three linemen, Otto, Schell, and Upshaw. And then after that, it's probably Howie Long, and then it's either Stabler or Plunkett. So it's why, while I don't have an issue with you putting him where he is, and he's certainly a player of considerable accomplishment, and I think I ended up having him 12th on my list overall, I wouldn't call him the best Raider ever, because the Raiders, like I said, they're a funny team, is that you can come up with six or seven guys and not be wrong. Willie Brown, I think, has been downgraded by everybody, because there was a significant period in his career when he was hands down the best defensive back in the game, and by a fairly wide margin. But I don't have any issues with anybody on your list. I think you might have a little bit of recency bias with Curry or a love of Curry, but that's a small thing to quibble about. So I'm not going to.
I think I have both of those things, for the record.
Which is fine, because the only, and that's the thing about the list. The only parameter was, did they ever play in the Bay Area? After that, it's judgment, and you can apply as much or as little scholarship as you want.
Right.
It's now, it's how some people end up with Charles Woodson on their list.
Yeah. And by the way, since Joe Fortenbaugh's number one and his number two, I don't believe, appeared on anyone else's list, except for when Lorenzo Neal remade his on the fly so Joe wouldn't yell at him. Outside of that, no, Joe's list was clearly the worst list compiled. Everyone else's, you could say, repeats an awful lot, but that means that we're all right. You know,
there's a consensus
that means
developing.
Yes, there's a consensus. People who know sports in this area, all, you know, we rarely agree on anything. We seem to be agreeing on quite a bit of this. Ray, I would say that your only reaches were the Ledecky thing and the Tiger Woods thing, and we all know that they're wonderful, and in Tiger's case, for a minute there, the single greatest ever, most dominant golfer, if we pretend Jack never existed. But I get it. You know, I hear what you're saying. To me, though, even though he spent, you know, yes, he was at Stanford, 2 years on the farm doesn't make you a Bay Area athlete in my mind. In your mind, I get it. I'm not here to argue.
I just went by the parameters that we were given by our cruel and stupid boss, they played in the Bay Area at some point. I took that literally.
My biggest blowback is I'm getting a lot of grief for O.J. Simpson. I think people forgot who O.J. was. From San Francisco, born here, high school, City College. He went on to win a Heisman Trophy, first back ever over 2,000 yards. And I know he did it somewhere else, but again, he's from all here. He's the only player, I believe, on this list that is on the 75th and 100 greatest NFL teams of all time. I don't know if Jerry was on that list because he was in there. Was he? Yeah. Well, I mean,
wasn't he? I could be wrong, but I thought
he was. I don't know when this cutoff point was for Jerry.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've gone too long here. Good list by Kolsky. Great list by me, so-so list by Ratto, and that's how I want it remembered by everyone.
It was a crap list by me, and the worst thing about it was that other people thought they wanted to tell me what their list was. And I don't care what their list was, because I don't care what my list was.
You know, it's just the whole point of the thing, but, you know.
Brett McMurphy is on our guest list, and he joins us next talking about a big day for college football decisions, certainly in the Ivy League. What will the ripple effect be? Stay with us, Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
I've never circled a Wednesday because of an Ivy League football announcement, but I circled this one knowing that the Ivy League was going to make a football announcement that might be a harbinger of things to come. Now, it's a little bit of a different circumstance for them than it is for the big boys, but we also saw the Ivy League being the first to pull out of the NCAA, and even though those championship parameters are much different, after 48 hours of laughing, the NCAA tournament was canceled. The Ivy League today made the decision to postpone, We were expecting a decision of postponement. The decision was made to cancel. Now, maybe we will see football in the spring, but as of right now, that is not guaranteed. To talk about that and the latest breaking news from around the world of college football, the man who is as state-of-the-art covering the sport as anybody out there. From Stadium Network, Brett McMurphy, good enough to join us here again on Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky, 95.7 The Game. Brett, thank you very much for joining us once again. How you doing?
Great. Good to be back with you guys. Hope everybody out there is safe and well.
We're doing our best to stay that way. And, you know, it looks like the Ivy League is making the same decision. What do you think about the decision today that they're not even going to entertain any sport at all until after the new year?
Well, I think, you know, it makes a lot of sense for them. And, you know, you kind of address this in the open. But this necessarily does not automatically mean that this is what the Power Five conferences or the Group of Five conferences will do. Now, they may end up doing the same thing, but it won't be because the Ivy League did it. The biggest difference between this and what happened in March with them being the first basketball tournament to shut down is the power conferences, the FBS conferences, have so much more at stake financially to play football. You know, the Ivy League does not have the football income that the FBS schools do. Certainly the TV revenue is, I'm not even sure if Ivy League does have any TV revenue, and certainly their gate attendance in no way compares with the bigger schools. So the bigger schools are going to wait until the last minute to decide what they can do and if they can guarantee the safety and health of the student athletes. Then they will go ahead and play as long as they can, whether that's 3 games, 5 games, 12 games. But I don't think by any means that by all the athletic directors and people I talked to in the sport, they weren't looking at this saying, well, if Ivy shuts down, then we're definitely going to shut down. That may end up being the case, but I don't think it means anything either way. But like you said, the Ivy, they may entertain moving the football season to the spring. That's something they'll figure out at a later date.
How likely is it that what Stanford did today will be far more influential on Power Five and, well, Division I schools in general than what the
Ivy League? Yeah, Ray. You know, it's pretty much up to each school, but that really shocked a lot of people. I mean, you know, you guys know Stanford, 36 sports, they cut 11 of them. But, you know, to look at it the other way, Stanford had more sports than any other school but one in the country. So, but basically, that's what all this is gonna come to. And I think, you know, last time I talked to you guys, you know, this was some of these hard decisions that presidents and athletic directors were gonna make. Was not only was the impact of COVID, but also you add in the fact that you're probably not gonna get 100% of your football revenue. So then, you know, how are you gonna recoup those losses? Well, the ADs, the presidents, they've got to decide, are we going to cut sports? Are we going to lay off individuals? Are we going to have people take furloughs? Are we going to do all of the above? Are we going to cut salaries? They've got to come up to a solution to meet these deficits. And unfortunately for Stanford, that meant, you know, 11 sports and a couple of hundred student athletes, and I think over two dozen jobs not related to the sports that were cut. You know, look, guys, if football gets moved to the spring or doesn't happen at all, there is not one single university in America that's not going to have substantial losses.
You said that, you know, the SEC, the Power Five conferences may have to postpone or cancel, but it won't be because of the Ivy League. What are the conditions that will force that?
Basically, the virus and how, you know, if one, can they guarantee the health and safety of the student athletes? And then also, you know, there's going to be a difference between the power leagues and the non-power leagues based on the cost of testing. The power leagues can afford to test, you know, hundreds of players weekly or more than that. Quite frankly, the group of five leagues, the, you know, specifically out your way, the Mountain West, you know, some of the smaller non-football leagues out there, West Coast Conference, et cetera, you know, they simply don't have the money to pay for all those tests. And so if you can't guarantee the safety and health of these players, then if you can't test them frequently enough, then you can't let them play. And I think that's ultimately will be the determining factor. And even in that scenario, at a Power Five conference school, whether it was the Pac-12, the SEC, Big Ten, let's say they've got a test and they can get the results in 2 or 3 days. I'm not sure how quickly they can do things now, but we'll say a couple of days. Well, they test on Tuesday, they get the results on Thursday or Friday, and they find out who all tested negative, and those guys can go play on Saturday. Well, how do we know that those individuals didn't test positive on Wednesday, on Thursday, or on Friday? So that's the big challenge right now, and that's why I reached out to all 130 athletic directors the past couple of days. I did that back in April, asked them their thoughts on the upcoming college football season. I did that again this week and asked them for their thoughts on the college football season. I'll have the story out tomorrow. I don't want to scoot myself, but one thing that jumped out to me is when I asked the ADs in April how many thought that there would not be a football season during the 2021 academic year, only one AD said that there wouldn't be a season. When I asked him this week, eight ADs thought there would not be any football at all. So that's kind of, you know, maybe the reality of that is starting to sink in. And look, we've still got, we're not going to know definitively either way until the end of July or August 1st on what's going to happen at the FBS level.
Just a quick follow-up on that. You're saying, and obviously you're right, that they have the money to test the players. Clearly, they don't have the money to test the student body. So in your mind, they would have football on a campus where there are no students besides football players.
Well, they've said they won't do that if there are no students. The way they've couched it is if they said there are some students. So right. Some students could be 100, it could be 1,000. It's certainly not going to be 20,000 students. So that's the way they've couched that. And yes, certainly that's how they would do it. But then you get into, that's why the results of my survey for tomorrow, majority of the ADs think that we'll just have a conference-only schedule. The reasoning for that is if you're in the Pac-12 and you're playing a team in the Mountain West, and the Mountain West does not have the same testing guidelines or safety protocols that the Pac-12 does, then are you comfortable playing against those teams if you can't be assured that they have the same testing guidelines and standards that you do? I think because of that, all over the country, that I think we'll just see these conferences play conference-only schedules, and I would expect the season probably to start in late September or early October.
College Football Insider at Stadium Network, Brett McMurphy joining us here. The man is connected again. 130 athletic draft. Is that a group email that you send out to talk to that many people at once?
Or I send it individually, but it is a cut and paste. Yeah.
Wow, look at that. That's an awful lot of work. That's just, you're asking for carpal tunnel. You really are. Brett, today, in this half hour, you tweeted that Ohio State has paused all voluntary workouts on campus following the results of a most recent COVID-19 test of student-athletes. The school doesn't release the number of positive tests. On the flip side, a school like Wisconsin does. They said that they have 7 positive tests out of 428 tests given to their students. Now, when it comes to maintaining privacy, HIPAA, I totally get it. But isn't not sharing the number feels a little sinister to me.
I agree. And they said it's because of the HIPAA laws and they don't want players to be identified. You know, look, this is not, you know, this is not making out your depth chart. And if a guy's going to play because you don't want the opposing coach to know if your starting quarterback's healthy or not. This is a public health issue. And you know, it is weird how different schools are so drastically different. I mean, North Carolina shut down their volunteer workouts. They had 37 tests positive. Notre Dame, 252 tests to date, only one positive test. Boston College, I think one positive test from a couple of hundred student athletes. So it is weird how certain schools have clustered a lot of positive tests and others, you know, only have a handful. But, you know, that's kind of the world we're in right now.
How much of that test counting, though, because it's left to individual schools, how much can other schools trust those? Because at some point, those other schools are going to interact with this. Well, every school will interact with every other school at one point or another. And if there isn't at least some mechanism for sharing the numbers, if not names, why would any school trust that the team they're going to play on any given Saturday, A, has been keeping accurate records, and B, not putting not only their own players at risk, but yours as well?
No, I mean, believe me, when we start getting into competition and you've got a team that needs to win to get into the playoff, you're like, what if you just play this one game? You'll be all right. I mean, hopefully it's not going to come to that, but certainly I would think that if a school has guys that test positive, whether they reveal those numbers or not, that they wouldn't put that player amongst their other players, because then you're going to, you know, potentially spread it to the entire team, and then you're going to have to forfeit the entire season. So I think that's the biggest safeguard, if you will. But, you know, I don't think we're going to see any schools identify players that test positive. You have seen some players at different schools have come out and said it on their own, but I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where we will see that the individual student athletes will be identified. Although, you know, come game day, game week when we're playing, certainly people will be going through the roster to see who made the trip and then, you know, figuring out who's not playing. If they're not injured, you'll probably figure it out.
We've talked about the financial impact of this an awful lot. Have you thought much about how it affects the implement of players owning their own name, image, and likeness rights?
No, not really. I mean, everybody, you know, is so deep into with the blinders on trying to figure out how to get this season played, whether it's conference only, whether it's moved to spring, whether it's moved to late September, you know, where the name, image, and likeness, you know, is basically taking a back seat. And I think also that, you know, somebody asked me today about what about college basketball? What's going to happen with that? And I said, well, you know, they're kind of an afterthought right now because all these schools have to figure out football, because football is the one that drives the bus with the revenue. And then once they get that figured out, or at least have an idea what's going to happen, then I think they'll address some of these other issues. But right now there's not a lot of talk. I mean, I know Congress is looking into that and coming up with different plans and so forth and so on, but that's not going to come to fruition for another year. So the main goal of everyone involved in college athletics right now is trying to figure out, you know, what in the heck's going to happen with the upcoming season.
Brett, thanks so much for joining us again. This was illuminating. This was really good to talk to you. Journalist with a capital J, we don't get a lot of those around here, so thank you.
Okay, hopefully in 3 weeks we'll definitively know something and then go from there, and it'll be a wild ride.
It should be. Thank you so much. Brett McMurphy, Stadium Network, here on 95.7 The Game, talking about the decision the Ivy League made today. I want to get back to Stanford cutting 11 varsity sports. That is men's and women's fencing, field hockey, lightweight rowing, men's rowing, co-ed and women's sailing, squash, synchronized swimming, men's volleyball, and wrestling. The 11 programs consist of more than 240 student athletes, 22 coaches losing their jobs. In those don't matter Olympic sports to a lot of you, Stanford has won 20 national championships and has earned 27 Olympic medals. It might not be a big deal to you, but these are big deal to the Stanford culture and their athletic department, which was, I should say, among the most robust athletic departments offering varsity sports in the entire nation. As a matter of fact, 36 varsity sports, only one other entity offered that. And I believe, Ray, correct me if I'm wrong, that entity was the entirety of the UT system, the University of Texas system. So it's not just Austin, it's all of Texas. I mean, so Stanford had an incredible amount of sports being offered. The average campus, by the way, just to compare, offers around 18 varsity sports. The letter from the president, the provost, and the athletic director reads, "In consultation with the Board of Trustees, we have made the decision to reduce the breadth of our athletics program and staffing, and that is why Stanford will discontinue 11 of our varsity sports programs at the conclusion of this academic year. Any kid who is on scholarship gets to remain on scholarship to the completion of their undergraduate degree." So good on Stanford there. The sad thing is over the course of 4 years, would have been 240 high school students receiving the vacated, graduated, moved on from school scholarships that open through matriculation. I mean, this is 240 students who might have been granted an education at Stanford who now may be denied. I mean, it's sad no matter how you want to look at it. Opportunity lost for the kids that are there. Opportunity lost for the kids that will never be there now because that sport is not offered there. And then just when you look at the history of the university, you know, Stanford's athletic department might not do an awful lot to move the needle here, but it is robust and it is decorated. And this is a tough pill to swallow.
And it does move the needle within those worlds, within the Olympic world, within the worlds of those sports specifically. It's a huge needle mover.
And the other thing is that Stanford has always made part of its pitch to prospective students that you will be able to do things here that you won't be able to do anywhere else. And yeah, those sports may not be a big part of that, but it was part of the overall sort of selling point of Stanford that, you know, yeah, it's really hard to get in, but once you're here, you will have an experience that people at other universities can't have because we offer more of everything, which means more arts classes, more science. I mean, just there are more opportunities to find whatever an individual student's bliss might be. And now, for the first time, at least that I can ever remember, what they're saying is there's a limit to what we can do. We can't be big dreamers anymore.
Well, and they're
the
solution.
Saw this. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm saying they're the solution people. I mean, this is a smart group of people who are, I mean, borderline experts in solving problems. That's what brilliant people are. They're problem solvers. Stanford looked at solving this problem in a wide variety of ways, through broadcast revenue, through funding, philanthropic support, operating budget reductions, robbing from Peter to pay Paul. Like, these are the solution seekers, and they could not find a solution other than kill 11 sports. That's scary.
Yeah, it,
well,
it wasn't
I think
that they...
It's, it,
go ahead.
Just quickly, I said this earlier, and I think the more I think about it, the more this is being driven home for me. They just don't view Stanford sports as the priority that certainly we in the sports world, or that really maybe a lot of people at large, might. They view Stanford education as the ultimate priority, and this strikes me as the kind of move that says we'd rather cut 11 sports than lose a dime for our for the education of our students.
But we don't know what else they did that wouldn't be under the auspices of the athletic department.
That's true. So, but they also didn't cut football.
Well,
you know,
we don't. Yeah, I know that David Shaw's salary's been cut. I know his staff salary's been cut. I don't know what else they've done there. By the way, Brent McMurphy said earlier that North Carolina has paused all its voluntary workouts. Ohio State has now, too, for all of its fall sports, including men and women's basketball. Well, men and women's basketball, field hockey, football, men and women's soccer, and volleyball.
So that's getting into winter sports as well. That's not just fall
sports.
Yeah,
it's basically – and it's basically not it, – it's the money generators, too. So, you know, this is – when you put all these things together, the Ivy League not playing football – I think we'll have less of a ripple effect than big schools with big athletic budgets going, we can't work out because we can't guarantee players' safeties.
You know,
safety,
at,
I'm sorry.
At Stanford, they had been weighing making these decisions for several years. This was the COVID-19 essentially just accelerated a decision-making process that was probably on the track to extreme cuts anyways. And I thought these numbers were really illuminating. And look at how quickly we jump from you're going to lose $12 million to you're going to lose $70 million. Listen how quickly this happens. So Stanford, doing all their bean counting, said that by financial year 2021, they were on track, pretty much collision course, to lose $12 million as an athletic department overall. $12 million for Stanford is a tic-tac. You can swallow that, right? They can do that. They can do that in the name of, we're Stanford, we don't trim the fat, we're going to do that. Then, changing life, as we're experiencing right now, made them push out that number to financial year 2021 to, hey, we might be losing $25 million. Did we say 12? Now it's 25. If the Pac-12 television money dried up because you had to cancel a football season, Stanford is looking at a $70 million loss financial year 2021. These sports, which will never come back, says Stanford, these sports cost about $200 million to do it at a world-class level. And they say, look, we're Stanford. If we can't do it at the world-class level, we're not going to do it. And it's just a monster move. Cutting these 11 sports is just, it might not be big to you, but it's big to the equation that every other athletic director is going to be studying carefully. When we come on back, we have our longest segment of the day, commercial-free interruption. We got it for you over the next 45 or so minutes. Brian Geltzeiler on the NBA's bubble. It's been a long time since we've talked to him. He's one of our favorite NBA conversations. He's coming up at 5 o'clock. A What If Wednesday also around the corner. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, brought to you by Fremont Bank. Full service banking, no compromises.
Now back to Damon Ratto and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
Good to have you here today, Raheem Mostert. Demanding a trade from the San Francisco 49ers. Ryan Baldinger at 5:30 coming up to talk about that little bit of breaking news this afternoon. Look good, feel good, play good. It's an important formula. Every girl's crazy about a sharp-dressed man. It's important to learn. Good
ZZ
to know.
Top, good band. Also important to learn.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. You don't need the Eliminator MTV stuff. Got to go
no,
back.
No.
You got to go Trace Ombres, ZZ Top.
There you go. Trace Ombres. That's where you want to start.
I don't know where you guys started putting together your Let Me Dress Up collection. For a lot of people, the first suit that they looked at was a Brooks Brothers suit, and that might not be happening the way that it used to. I don't know if you guys saw this today, but Brooks Brothers has filed for bankruptcy. Brooks Brothers, founded in 1818. I mean, it's been around a while. $991 million in sales last year, and again, today they are filing for bankruptcy. They have dressed over 40 presidents, countless captains of industry. It is the official uniform of the New York stockbroker, Brooks Brothers. Kind of a big deal. And, I mean, Stanford is trimming. Stanford is cutting sports of one of the most robust athletic departments ever assembled. Brooks Brothers is going bankrupt. Saw this. Bed Bath & Beyond is going to be closing 200 of its 1,000 stores in the next 2 years. A wave of evictions is about to hit America that is going to be so disastrous that who knows what the ramifications might be. And my God, when we get back to, hey, how's this sport going to open up? Do you think the NBA is going to be fed well inside of its Orlando bubble? I mean, I just look at these things and I think, man, none of this really matters compared to all the stuff that's going on. I mean, good Lord, it is a world that is almost unrecognizable when you really peer out your window.
Odwalla went out of business.
Odwalla?
Yeah, well, what's crazy is... Well, but they haven't been for a while. I mean, it's really, what, Coca-Cola deciding not to produce it anymore?
Nevertheless, yeah.
Yeah.
People who liked very opaque juices made from whatever.
Still have 35 options, but yeah. R.I.P. Odwalla.
If you like to chew your smoothie, Odwalla was for you.
Yeah, there's also like 12 boutique shops in the city alone for you, so chill. It'll be okay.
Yeah, by the way,
no shade to Odwalla, RIP.
12 boutique shops, probably down to 2 by this time, 2 months from now. You know, I mean, that's
God forbid.
The way it is. It is it's a scary, scary time out there, and we come back returning to the world of sports and saying, what about our entertainment? How's our entertainment gonna be set up? And I don't know. I just don't know how much it really matters. I know that the Giants. The A's, they are trying to restart their restart. COVID-2 electric boogaloo happening right now. The A's yesterday got the news that Jesus Luzardo had tested positive. Today, Jake and Amanda Diekman were none too pleased with baseball's COVID testing. And in an article I saw on The Athletic, the numbers just were simply this. You know, let's say Utah's testing lab that baseball is using gets 15,000 tests to clear per week. So that's more than 2,100 tests per day. I mean, is that lab functioning 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? We know that it was not functioning over 4th of July weekend, which led to so many workouts being canceled and team activities being delayed. The Giants did resume workouts today. They did finally get their test results back that they were waiting for. After 2 positive COVID tests over the weekend, the next batch of tests is returned. No one has tested positive this time around. But baseball is just banging its head against a bad start. There is no doubt.
Yeah, they've done everything wrong. So it seems like getting excited for opening day would be on brand because it won't happen. It's staggering how not aware, how not being able to look into the future more than 15 minutes has cost them. I mean, even hockey, which everybody has always thought was a backward sport, they just did a memorandum of understanding with its players that basically said if enough players decide to opt out because they're worried about the safety of playing in the pods in Toronto and Edmonton, there isn't going to be punishment. The two sides will gather again to talk together about whether to to continue the playoff plan. It's cooperation rather than confrontation. And it's a sign that if you don't work together, you'll die separately. Those are your choices.
I mean, I think that's a good metaphor for America right now. You know, that this needs to be about both sides in terms of baseball, not America. But in terms of baseball, this needs to be about both sides respecting each other. Like, and if there's not a foundation of respect and at least a modicum of trust, it's hard to imagine how any of this is going to get done. But again, we've said this for a few days. I can't really imagine how this is going to get done with any plan that doesn't at least try to put players and teams in some kind of bubble. If you're flying around the country, like, I just don't see any scenario where it's safe or reasonable to start flying teams of, I mean, I don't know what the traveling party's supposed to be, 30, 40, 50, back and forth, even just from San Francisco to LA. Even just that level of regular travel seems crazy to me.
Oh, it's because it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's, and it's more than, and it's more, I mean, because teams are going to be flying with each other. So double that, plus the umpiring crews are going to be traveling with the teams. So basically, you're going to have close to full airline flights anytime, you know, teams are going in the same place. I mean, just it's, there's a level of madness about this that basically says the one thing we said 3.5 months ago that they couldn't do, which was you can't put the virus after the money. And all they've done throughout this whole process is try to put the money before the virus.
I mean, isn't that what tripped the United States? I mean, sports is the microcosm of society. Look at around the world. Look at the countries that handled COVID-19 well. What do they have in common? How aggressive they were from the very, very start to get it right. The starting blocks that every successful country broke out of determines where you are right now. We not only got out of the starting block terribly, we fell over 12 times on the first lap. We sat down to sunbathe on the second lap, ordered pizza on the third lap, just not even paying attention to the damn race that we're running. And that has caught the situation we're in is only here due to 5 months of galactic mismanagement. Horrific decisions from not just the top on down, but the horrific decisions are coming from the bottom on up. What do I mean by that? The dumbest among us. The dumbest among us. Virtue signaling. I don't wear a mask because I need my liberty. I mean, it's the Aubrey Huffification of America. Hubris, arrogance, ignorance, proudly brandished in the name of bootlicking a total bully. It's staggering. I mean, I really, you know, it takes a lot for me to say I am completely disappointed with everything I see. I am completely disappointed with almost everything I see out of this situation. I mean, where is the silver cloud other than, like, you know, you got to kind of make it up to feel good about it. Hasn't this little province or country or whatever done a nice job? Or isn't this a lovely thing? We get to spend more time with our kids. Yeah, it's great and all. But I think I'd rather Jack be in daycare and 135,000 people still be alive.
You drive a hard bargain. These are today's numbers from COVID-19 tracking. Newly reported cases, 62,000, up from 52,000 yesterday. And the positive test rate has gone from 8.4% on the first of the month to 9.3% today.
Mortality has been looking better and better and better and better, but now that has turned to. We're seeing more and more deaths. and we might approach over a thousand again a day soon.
Yeah, yesterday was 922. Today is 897. A week ago it was 700.
It was down.
So
to
the death total is going up again too.
Yeah,
it's tremendously disconcerting, and the upsetting thing, honestly, whatever the reason, is to see. You know, there's a graph making the rounds today that shows the American response as opposed to the European Union response. And as we well know, I mean, look, I remember maybe the clearest, most explosive moment in my understanding of how serious this situation was seeing the reporting in Italy before it ever really hammered us, right? And that's part of the European Union. And almost uniformly, they've got it under control in a way that we are not even approaching. We are not even trending vaguely towards. And it's really discouraging because there are literally dozens of countries with the blueprint for how to handle the situation. And because of widespread, proud ignorance in our country, we are unable to do that. And it's discouraging.
You would think. Maybe we can count on these kids in college to make some smart decisions, even though I got to tell you, smart decisions weren't exactly the hallmark of my collegiate career. Never quite faced with the prediction of a pandemic. UC Berkeley, just saw this. UC Berkeley has 47 new COVID cases, mostly from a week of fraternity parties. This on top of the news that they're intentionally trying to get COVID-19 at Alabama parties. You know, City Council had to like call in the police to make sure that parties stopped specifically inviting COVID-19 patients to infect the party.
You know what? I mean, look, Damon, there's no doubt that Cal story is dumb and the Alabama story is dumber. But just think about the level of straw we have to grasp at when we are saying, well, the president and the government and half of the local leaders in the country can't figure this out, but maybe some 19, 20-year-old frat kids will get it for us.
Never a good place to place your bets.
Not good.
Ask Bernie Sanders. That's another story. Okay. On that note, welcome one and all to your 5 o'clock hour.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game. KGMZ FM and HD1 San Francisco, a radio.com sports station.
There was a picture last night that went around Twitter of the very first meal served inside the NBA bubble. I pointed out three things. Number one, even though it's an embarrassing looking amount of food, it's an amount of food that so many people in the world would be so thankful for that there's no reason to make any jokes about it. And then I said, now let me make my jokes about it. The NBA bubble might not be canceled for any other reason than every army only marches on its stomach. And I've already seen the people say, you know, that is just the first meal of isolation. The meals will improve. Well, I mean, they better, or the NBA's bubble will be over by lunchtime on Friday. That's how bad that one meal looked. To talk about that, the bubble, and all things NBA, a friend of the show, and it's been an awfully long time since we've said hello, to Brian Geltzeiler, at Hoops Critic is where you can find him on Twitter. You can find him on Sirius XM NBA Radio. Brian, long time, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Damon. It's great to be back with you guys, and I hope everybody's healthy and safe and holding up well in this crazy world we live in.
It is a crazy world we live in. It's a crazy world that even if you offer me the safety of a bubble, people are living in. As NBA teams start entering, what have you heard?